The views expressed on The Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you are interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment of the show, you are free to do so. Just send us an email so we know you're out there. If you'd like, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop. This week, last week actually, we spoke with Daniel McGowan. Daniel is from New York City, Queens actually, and talks about his start in activism with Earth First, his current views on his activities with the Earth Liberation Front, communication management units in the prison systems, prison gang structures, prisoner support, the Certain Days calendar designed by political prisoners, and more. You can find more about Certain Days at certaindays.org, and more about prisoner support work in New York City at nycabc.wordpress.com. If you're in New York City, check out the 2017 calendar release party this Saturday, November 12th, the Interference Archive at 1318 Street, Brooklyn, at 7 p.m. Before the interview, here's just one brief announcement. As we reported last week, Kinetic Justice has been on hunger strike since October 21st to protest his transfer to Limestone Correctional Facility, which is a notoriously dangerous supermax facility located in Harvest, Alabama. Prison officials are currently denying him water, and his support network is fearing for his safety. You can help by calling with your demands today. Call the Alabama Department of Corrections and Alabama Governor Robert Bentley's office demanding, one, that Kinetic Justice be transferred from Limestone Correctional Facility, and two, that Pastor Kenneth Glasgow of the Ordinary People's Society be allowed to visit him and assess his condition immediately. You can reach those two people, the Alabama Department of Corrections in Montgomery, Alabama, at area code 334-353-3883. Email them at webmaster@doc.alabama.gov. And Governor Robert Bentley can be found at 600 Dexter Avenue, Montgomery, Alabama, 36130. And you can call this gentleman at 334-242-7100. For more information about Kinetic Justice and his situation, you can visit the Free Alabama Movement at freealabamamovement.wordpress.com, and you can visit the Ordinary People Society at theordinarypeoplesociety.org. But first, here are some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain.
Our potty training plays an essential role in the maintenance of hierarchy. I know it's kind of a no-brainer that we can't have engineers and doctors and nuclear physicists strolling around while leaking body waste the way that horses and cows just handle business on the go. So in that obvious way, hierarchy is dependent upon our potty training for keeping things orderly and maintaining clean floors and preventing slip and fall accidents that leave your shoes smelling terrible. But I'm not really talking about that. Sure, on an obvious level, the process of potty training is about toddlers seizing control of their bowels. But the process of our potty training is also about others seizing control of our minds. In the course of potty training, representatives of the hierarchical control system hijack our sense of ourselves, our identities, and set us on a lifelong path of deference and deferment, looking to others for answers instead of ourselves. Consider, prior to potty training, we're happy little savages running around and pooping in the proverbial bushes. By and large, we are perfectly content with who we are. We have no concept that we should be anything other than ourselves, that there is anything wrong with us. But at the point where we are introduced to potty training, we are simultaneously introduced to the idea that there is something wrong with us in the state we are in. Being happy little savages isn't good enough. We must modify ourselves in order to be worthy of others' acceptance. We are introduced to the idea that we should be ashamed of who we are and if we fail to meet expectations. We encounter humiliation, which is used as a tool to alter our behavior. The shame and humiliation we experience are incredibly traumatic. I may have previously mentioned social science experiments, where college students were paid to eat and drink as much as they wanted, and were told they had only to urinate and defecate before exiting. Well, not until after they ate did they realize that there was no bathroom. They would have to go in their pants. What researchers learned was that most of those students couldn't do it. Many even risked serious medical harm or death, holding their bodily wastes. They would rather suffer serious pain and injury than soil their pants and go home. I think this speaks volumes to just how powerful the shame and humiliation of our potty training really is. In our adulthood, even years after we've lost all memory of the actual events, the trauma of potty training has so thoroughly altered us that we cannot bring ourselves to buck the potty training program, even to save our very lives. That's pretty powerful. Our senses of who we are, our very identities, are so tied to the larger program that we would rather die than fail to meet its expectations. We are so permanently traumatized and altered that we put the program even before our own survival. This being the case, our potty training didn't just provide us the tools for our own bowel control, which certainly comes in useful on occasion, like during high school dances when you're trying to impress your date. But it also hobbles us, alters us, convinces us that we only have value and worth if we become something useful for the larger program. It got us to meeting the demands of the system, to thinking of ourselves in relation to that system. We seek affirmation through conformity, validation through obedience, constantly deferring to others in order to get a sense of how we're doing. I would suggest that all of this is a consequence of that experience where we got transformed from happy little savages into swivelized and regimented subjects with our sphincters responsibly clenched. The process of our potty training changed our orientation to the world, to authority, to the program, and we're stuck that way for life. We're stuck in the habits of deference and deferment, attempting to improve and fix our brokenness, seeking to avoid shame and humiliation, struggling to meet the standards imposed on us by others, jumping eagerly through their hoofs for others' affirmation. The trauma of our potty training is our initiation into hierarchy and domestication. We can only transcend it if we can acknowledge and confront it and come to grips with its implications. I'm not suggesting we lose control of our bowels, just everything else that came with it. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
We're speaking with Daniel McGowan. Daniel is a longtime anarchist and ecological activist. He was swept up in 2006 in the FBI's Operation Backfire, a multi-agency sweep of radical ecological and animal rights activists. Daniel served 7 years for his role in two eco-actions claimed by the ELF, or the Earth Liberation Front. Daniel is now out of state custody and still an activist. Thanks a lot for taking time to have this chat, Daniel.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Would you care to talk a bit about what got you involved in anarchism and in activism?
Sure. Well, I grew up in New York City, in actually Queens, and I had It was about 1996. I had just gotten back from a trip to Southeast Asia. I had graduated college and spent a little bit of time in Thailand and Southeast Asia. And while I was there, I ran into human rights activists that were talking to me about issues going on in Southeast Asia at the confluence of sort of the logging industry and refugees, people from the hill tribes of Burma and Thailand that were essentially displaced due to the logging that was being promoted by the dictatorship that had just recently taken over in Burma. And so I had been exposed to this idea of like human rights and sort of people promoting the idea and as well as sort of the intersectional aspects of like working with people and the environment at the same time. And so I had had intentions of, I think at the time, if I recall, going into academia. I didn't really know what I wanted to do with myself. And so it was really interesting to meet people that were doing good work and trying to, you know, find a way in this world and, you know, to fight oppression and things like that. I got back to the United States and I sort of had a hard time finding people. I went to, you know, a number of different organizational meetings like the Sierra Club and things like that. And none of that really felt right. And then one day I went out. I actually went to a club in the Lower East Side and they had a rather expensive cover. And so I didn't have the money. And so I left and I ended up walking into this info shop called Blackout Books. It's no longer there, unfortunately. And that neighborhood is very different than it is now. But I had walked into Blackout Books and I had like checked out all the different categories and ways that info shops classified the books. That was very different than what I had known. And again, I was pretty broke at the moment. I didn't have much money. So I checked out their free pile. I have never actually seen a free pile in a store before up until that point. And I found a copy of the Earth First Journal and I checked it out. And a lot of it didn't make any sense to me in terms of like the lingo that was used. But the sentiment was definitely something I was interested in. And I sort of was working at this big, horrible company as a temp at the time. But I ran into this this woman who was receiving or asking people to sign a petition about, I believe it was spay and neuter of animals, of pets. And she had said, you know, from talking to me for like 2 minutes, she had ascertained that maybe the Sierra Club and different groups like that were not really my cup of tea. But she reinforced this idea that I should, you know, check out the local Earth First group, which happened to meet at a club called Wetlands. It was actually a club started by a guy named Larry Block from Vermont that had the purpose of channeling their profits into running activist campaigns. And so I got involved in that group and things were, you know, quite quickly progressed at that point, leading to me going to the Earth First Round River Rendezvous and then getting arrested for essentially standing on a street in Wisconsin in 1997, I believe.
What was the protest in Wisconsin?
Oh, it was against, it was actually ended up being rather successful. It was a protest against something called the Crandon Mine. It was in Crandon, Wisconsin. I think it was like Northwest Wisconsin. And it was like an open pit mine that was going to be built on the Wolf River, essentially pretty pristine kind of river in Wisconsin. And Earth Firsters were kind of in coalition with a lot of local Wisconsin groups and the Menominee tribe to sort of, you know, to stop it. And essentially a few years after that, it was pretty successful. But my time in Wisconsin was pretty interesting. I had not really done a lot of camping and exposure to like activist scene, which kind of blew me away. I got pretty radicalized. I'd say like my progression into anarchism came pretty, you know, naturally. I guess it's like a lot of us, we always feel like we had issues with authority or issues with like bullies and stuff like that. I was raised by actually a New York police officer, albeit not a very ideological one. My father essentially went and took one test in the 60s for like sanitation, fire, or the police, and the police called him first. So he had a young family and he became a cop. But you can imagine like having that kind of law and order kind of exposure, you know, has, I mean, it's not uncommon to run into anarchists who have parents in law enforcement. I think it's kind of funny how often it happens to me. So yeah, like I was never much one for the paper pushers that, you know, sell the newspapers with charismatic or not so charismatic leaders on them, you know, Revolutionary Communist Party and other assorted clownish groups like that. So anarchism always felt sort of natural for me.
And so your activism progressed, and just jumping ahead, so you were convicted, as I mentioned before in the introduction, for participation in what I consider one of the most interesting periods of eco and animal defense in the U.S. under the moniker of the Earth Liberation Front. Not that we should be defined by what our enemies say about us, but at this time prior to 9/11, the FBI had declared movements such as the ALF or the Animal Liberation Front and the Earth Liberation Front as domestic enemies, number one. What sort of reflections do you have about the efficacy and the direction of the ELF at that time, the model it promoted, and the popular engagement or lack thereof around that sort of activism?
Well, I do think it's interesting that at the time, I remember reading that I think it was the FBI Director Mueller had said that the ELF was the domestic terrorist group number one. And I used to think that was really bombastic and silly. But at the end of the day, it sort of makes sense in that the ELF and the ALF target property and are taking, you know, have taken big, you know, stances, obviously, on some pretty big social issues or issues affecting the ecology and the way we treat other species. So if you know, that's why when people are always like, oh, you know, they focus on the ELF and ALF and they don't focus on, you know, people committing like violent attacks against immigrants or racist nonsense. It sort of makes sense to me because at the end of the day, the state really doesn't care about that stuff. I mean, it cares about it only in order to look like it's like the protector of its citizens. But at the end of the day, I don't think the state really cares. When you're talking about attacking property and attacking industries, that's sort of more of a anti-capitalist gesture. You know, I mean, you can, racists can attack immigrants. It doesn't actually affect the runnings of capitalism. And so, you know, the government's not going to get too bent out of shape about, you know, 10,000 or more racist incidents a year in this country. I mean, I'd say that would be a low number. It's actually kind of interesting. Years ago, I think it was 2005, one of these lunatics that are in Congress, I don't know if it was Jeffords or Innes or one of these people, had hearings on so-called eco-extremism. And at the time, Barack Obama was a senator, U.S. senator from Illinois. And his whole presentation at this was basically, given all the hate crimes that have happened in Illinois, how can you focus on this? And at the time, I thought, well, that's interesting. It doesn't quite go far enough, but it's an interesting take, I suppose, on like terrorism. In terms of reflections on the efficacy and direction, you know, when you're involved in groups like the ELF or underground groups at the time, I of course, you know, you would think was okay with the direction that we were taking. I think when you're immersed in it and you're involved in planning actions or reconning or, you know, trying to figure out different research on how best to be effective, I think you're, you know, it's hard to be very critical. And I think sometimes groupthink takes over. I had always thought that the actions were a means to an end. They were a means, a tactic that would inform the strategy. And so I thought it would make sense that we would be choosing tactics that would inform our strategy, of which there was, you know, should be a, kind of like a short term, a middle term, and a long term. With the long term perhaps being having a deterrent effect on the, you know, old growth logging in the Northwest. Unfortunately, you know, the things we chose to do were really intense. And in that way, I think sometimes you find that what you're doing in one night could really have more impact than anything you had done previously. I mean, I've obviously been engaged in legal activism for years prior to that. And so I think it's very easy to get taken in by the media and taken in by the fact that, again, you're doing more in one night, theoretically, than you had done previously. So you get kind of, you lose sight, and maybe you start to not see the actions as a means to an end, but as an end in itself. I'd always had the wish or the desire to make, you know, the actions that we were involved in be part of a mosaic, you know, be part of the different actions that were going on these topics, not to have them be leading it, and never to think that somehow we can get everyone to just start doing what we were doing. In that way, when you're talking about popular engagement, I think what happened is we presented a picture to the movement of experts, of people that really knew what the hell we were doing and did these massive actions. And what does that do but essentially paralyze people? I mean, if you're observing these massive actions, you think to yourself, perhaps the ELF really has their act together, and therefore they got that covered. But I mean, a small group of 10 or so people do not have the issue covered. I mean, it requires like mass involvement. It requires lots of people doing lots of different things in order to have any level of success. Sort of has to be a continuum of activity and tactics. And so that's the problem, is that I feel like on some level we became experts. We became part of like a priest class of militant direct action. And that actually isn't good for popular engagement. It also, when you consider like arson and destruction of property, it's very polarizing. And I don't know if like militant polarizing tactics are the best way to build any sort of, I don't want to say unity, but like movement in the same direction. We're trying to like tackle these big issues that obviously have social components when you're talking about logging or genetic modification. And yet we were thinking that perhaps the more militant and more intense we got, we would have a greater impact. But in some ways, we basically polarized the issue and created sympathy for our opposition, which is never something you want to do. So all of this is easy in the rearview mirror. It's a lot harder when you're in the thick of it, you know, and it's easy for me 10 years later to look back. But at the time, I feel like we had our heart in the right place. We were very cautious and engaged and mindful people. And so I have no regret about the, you know, what we did in that way. I'm certainly relieved that we did not hurt ourselves or anyone else. That was never the goal, obviously. But I mean, that's been stated many times, of course.
And that comes out in the wash too, despite the rhetoric of the state and capitalist enterprises. But that's kind of interesting to hear you say that about the lack of engagement publicly, because I'd imagine that while there was the family or whatever, like the small group of people that were active, which was pretty obscured by privacy, like people on the outside not necessarily knowing that it was just one group of people that was hitting all these different places around the country. But it seemed like between distribution of materials about how to replicate the activities on one's own, in one's own hands, and the number of at least times that ELF and related tags got put up in places or items got attacked by people who weren't connected to the family, that it seemed like kind of a success in some ways, even if it didn't like spread like wildfire, at least it did sprout some smaller actions and activities in different places, in the way that like the ALF isn't like a body of people that's specific. It's people that choose to take action and certain activities and
sure,
reproduce the means. So I'm just kind of surprised to hear that.
Well, I mean, I do think, I don't want to be too harsh on myself, like, or us. Like, I do think there was some reproducibility to the actions. I do think, though, especially towards the end, they got very highly involved in technical. And I think the reaction to the materials that were actually put out by my crew was like, you know, sort of, holy crap, this is really technical. And I think that there has to be a level of entry for people in our movement that is not based on like having access to an understanding of technical skills. At the end of the day, you can overcomplicate things that are not that complicated. And I think that's partially what we did. But I do want to say also, you know, like our group was like fairly regionally involved, but, you know, largely in the Northwest. I mean, of course, there was definitely, anyone that's read the case knows that there's definitely incidents from the Midwest when people traveled. But for the most part, I mean, this group was kind of confined to the Northwest. And so, you know, there's a certain amount of actions that you can attribute to this larger group, but, or I should say the smaller group, but there's clearly many, many, many more incidents claimed by the EOF that had nothing to do with my case. So in that way, like, it could be seen as partially successful.
This is our conversation with formerly imprisoned eco-anarchist Daniel McGowan. This is The Final Straw Radio on Asheville FM, 103.3 LPFM, Asheville, North Carolina.
So you mentioned CMUs, or communication management units, and you wrote about this a little bit. We're almost snatched back into the prison for it, or into the prison system. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that incident and what CMUs are and how they differ from solitary or administrative segregation?
Yeah, sure. Well, the communication management units, or CMUs, Currently, there are two units in the federal system that we know about. One is at Marion, Illinois, and one is at Terre Haute, Indiana. They were sort of created out of this like knee-jerk reaction on the part of the Department of Justice. There was allegations made in 2003 or 2004 that prisoners in ADX, the Supermax prison in Florence, were in contact with some of the individuals that ended up conducting the Madrid bombings. And so because of that, this allegation, and I don't really know if it's true, the inspector general wrote a report about how communications in the federal system were not very monitored. And so the Bureau of Prisons put forth a policy called limited communication for terrorist inmates. They put forth that policy in the Federal Registry, the Code of Federal Regulations, and you know they sought public comment. So of course, the public comment ended up being unanimously against it. It was just thousands of letters, you know, put forth by, you know, people like the Center for the Constitutional Rights and ACLU, saying that basically having these intense conditions for people that are convicted of terrorist crimes is really punitive. And so the BOP took that back and they didn't do anything for another year. And then what they did is they opened up the communication management unit at Terre Haute in the old death row building. In fact, after the U.S. government killed Timothy McVeigh, they moved their death row to a different unit. And so the D unit in Terre Haute at the medium prison was just unused and left to basically just rot. And apparently when they opened up the CMU, the first batch of people that got there were just stunned at the fact that there were puddles in there and rats and rodents and tar slipping down the walls and such. It sounded like it was just kept, you know, unheated and unused for a couple of years. So what they did is essentially because they got slammed so hard at putting forth the public comment on this communication policy, they just created pretty much illegally. And this is under Bush and Gonzalez, but continued under Obama and Holder and Lynch. They just basically opened this unit and just put mostly people with terrorism crimes in it. And when I say terrorism crimes, some of that includes people who basically worked for charities that worked with the United Nations and USAID. And then suddenly the Bush administration decided that those people were aiding Hamas. And you have a whole bunch of people that are in a federal prison for essentially running charities that did things like buy soccer balls and blankets for children in Gaza, specifically referring to the Holy Land Foundation case. But there's others like that. And so these are the people that essentially were put in the CMU. The Washington Post called it the junior varsity squad of terrorist prisoners in the United States, which I thought was a fascinating way of describing it. So I ended up, passed through the federal prison system on the way to Sandstone. I was on the bus, I was on the plane, what they call Conair. I saw the Terre Haute CMU, I saw the men standing at the gate as we were coming in. I asked the bus driver, which inexplicably is a man with a hook, an amputee with a hook that drives prisoners around the system. And he told us that that was the terrorist unit. And I thought to myself that I really lucked out that, you know, somehow I ended up at Sandstone despite the fact that I had the terrorism enhancement. And, you know, lo and behold, 9 months later, I get called down to the mailroom and thinking that I owed postage, I have a book of stamps in my hands to give to the cop for my books. And invariably, I'm given two empty boxes and told I need to put all my possessions in there and come back in 20 minutes, which I did. And I got put in the SHU for the night, the secure housing unit. And the next day, I'm on the way to Marion. And so I was essentially one of the first batch of people that got sent to the second CMU, the one that's at Marion Prison, which used to be the Supermax before Florence was opened in the mid-90s. I spent 26 months at the CMU at Marion. I filed a lawsuit in 2010 with the help of the Center for Constitutional Rights, as well as some of my fellow residents of the CMU, Yassine Aref, and the mom from Albany that was entrapped, and a man named Kifa Jayusi, who was one of the people that did fundraising and for essentially Muslim charities that was then given material aid to support terrorism charges. So we filed this lawsuit in 2010. About a few months later, I got moved to general population at Marion. Everything was going well until I found out that a website, I believe it was publicintelligence.net, had received either hacked or leaked documents about the CMU. I had asked my wife at the time to show my lawyers these documents and see if I can have them. And if I can have them, my lawyer could send them in. This is sort of something I did many times, is just have my lawyer assess whether or not it was okay for me to receive documents. At that point, they said that I was trying to circumvent the mail monitoring, and they put me in the shoe. And I was on a bus the next day, specially driven from Marion, Illinois to Terre Haute, Indiana. And I did 22 more months at the CMU before I was released to the halfway house in December 2012. So, but in terms of the CMUs, they're sort of a novel thing. You know, in the federal system, you have minimums, lows, mediums, and highs. And then you have one supermax that has 430 prisoners in it. That's the people that are locked down 23 hours a day. You also have special management units in Lewisburg. In fact, there was a really great article published today in the Marshall Project that talks about a man that was held, that essentially was handcuffed for 28 days because he refused to cell in with an individual who had very, very obvious and clear mental health issues at the special management unit at Lewisburg. It's fascinating.
And by cell in, you mean like getting into the cell and like moving in with someone who might be dangerous to them.
Exactly. So the special management unit is essentially the BOP's attempt to conduct so-called gang rehabilitation. So it's essentially like a tiny cell, at most 6x9, but more than likely 4x8, which you can imagine two grown males in there is horrible. And they'll take a blood and a Crip or a gangster disciple and a blood and put them in there. And then basically, you know, it's barbaric because, you know, what are people going to do? Either they're going to, you know, either they're going to fight to the death, presumably stabbing each other, or they're going to just, you know, have to drop out of their gang because there's consequences for not attacking enemies of your gang. And it's horrible. I mean, the article in the Marshall Project is insane. So what my point, though, being that, like, you know, they have these units in the federal system that are barbaric, right? The CMU is a totally different thing. CMU is essentially made up for people like myself who, you know, when I was at Sandstone, I never got a disciplinary infraction. I never spent any time in the secure housing unit. What I did do, though, was I was working on a master's degree with Antioch University. I had professors and instructors that I had worked with to develop syllabi for a sociology degree. And part of that sociology degree was looking critically at the work that I was doing, at the work that I had done, and sort of looking at the environmental resistance movements through a sociological lens. So of course I'm using the computers at the, you know, education department at Marion and at Sandstone, and this is what part of the reason why they freaked out. They thought I was, you know, either promoting crime or, you know, maybe I wasn't being critical enough about things I was involved in. I don't actually think they read anything. I think they literally just saw ELF and they freaked out. And so when they were opening up this terrorist unit, so to speak, they needed some people that weren't Muslim that had the terrorism enhancement. And I totally fit that myself and people like Andy Stepanian, who had an animal rights free speech case, the Shaq case. They put in a former member of the Brotherhood, a Nazi who had been in for 30 years with, you know, relatively few incident reports. They put in sovereign citizens, one of these like sort of insane people who like are, you know, have a lot of obsessions with like either getting rich quick or getting out of prison and putting quadrillion-dollar liens on federal judges, that sort of stuff, usually rooted in like some form of white supremacist ideology, but not always.
You got to admit that sometimes some of that, like the lien stuff, I think is pretty hilarious.
I mean, it's pretty hilarious. I don't actually understand how a person is able to put, I mean, they, when they would tell me and show me the paperwork, I was like, I don't even know how to say that number. And they'd be like, oh, quadrillion, bazillion. And I was literally like unsure whether or not they were lying or not, but it had so many zeros. And so you can imagine they put a lien on a judge and then a judge goes to buy something from Home Depot and they're like, no, I'm sorry, your credit's denied. It's just like, but you know, they're sort of like, you know.
But they're Nazis, which sucks.
So, you know, they're mostly racist, but then you have a large amount of them that are black folks from like the Moorish Science Temple or whatnot. And so it's like a weird element of like confluence of like white supremacist language and black nationalism in a way. It's usually a little wacky and they're never, you know, they do things like try to intervene on lawsuits. So we had a lawsuit and they tried to intervene and it totally slowed down our whole process. We obviously wanted to sue about the conditions. We didn't want to sue about the way the flag was hanging or Title 18 or marine law or any other kind of kooky stuff that they talk about. And so, you know, I was in the CMU. Basically, we used to joke I was a two-time, you know, CMU person. We used to make fun of the people that ended up getting out and then get put back in the CMU. I was essentially put back as an example, like, you know, to break me off. I actually didn't try to circumvent the mail monitoring, but there's no way to really reasonably explain to the BOP that you're not trying to do this, you know? So it's different from solitary or ADSEG because when you're in transit, you're in what's called administrative segregation. It's essentially segregation, but not for disciplinary reasons, although the conditions are exactly the same. You're stuck in a 6x9 cell for, you know, 23 hours minimally a day. They might come to your cell at 4 o'clock to do recreation. If you're awake and on your feet, maybe you can get an hour of recreation, which is essentially in like a big cage, you know, and it's freezing, of course. And so administrative segregation is pretty harsh. Disciplinary segregation is pretty much the same, except you're in there usually on a sanction. So you might get, let's say there's an incident, you might get put in administrative segregation while the internal police at the prison are actually investigating. And then one day you just magically, you know, you go to the board, you get found guilty, and they give you 30 days in the SHU. And so then suddenly you're at disciplinary segregation, and maybe they don't let you have your radio, or maybe you can only have one book instead of five. I'm not really sure. But all those things are essentially like cell-based living, you know? At the CMU, you're stuck in the unit with all the people in the unit. You never really ever leave the unit unless they lock down the whole prison, but you're not in your cell. You're essentially just making your way. You do recreation, healthcare, religious services, everything is in one place, education. So it's very stifling. It's very – the tedium of the CMU is very tough to deal with, and you have to devise ways to essentially do your time in a way that's productive, you know, and not just like staring at the soap operas and whatnot, which some people do.
Can you talk a little bit more about like you had gotten out, you were in a halfway house, and when you published an article on the CMU, right?
Okay, yeah. So I was at the halfway house, and when you're at a halfway house, you're essentially still in custody. They just call it community custody. So all the rules of the BOP still apply to you. So I had written a number of articles when I was in the CMU and when I was at general population, articles about current events, about the drug war, about the people that I was doing time with, about how messed up prison is, all these kind of sort of obvious articles, but maybe not so obvious for our community, which at the time hadn't really dealt with a lot of friends and allies inside. And so I had known that it was like pretty, you know, it was okay to write articles as long as you're not sitting there and promoting some sort of violence or crime or whatever. So I wrote a rather bland article on like a Tuesday about the status of my lawsuit. The lawsuit at the time was called Aref v. Holder. Now it's Lynch because she is the attorney general. So I write this like summary of an article. And then like the next day I come back from work and I realize that I don't have a work pass approved. And obviously the halfway house is trying to make a bunch of money off you. So they want you to go to work. So if you don't go to work, then they can't take a percentage of your pay. So I knew something was wrong. I called my lawyer. I called my wife at the time. And I told them, you know, something's wrong. I'm probably going to, you know, be taken to MDC, probably going to be taken back to prison. Lo and behold, the next day they call me down and, you know, with some kind of ruse about, you know, Miss Johnson wants to talk to you. And so I pack up all my stuff and I walk down there with my bag because I don't want the cops packing my locker up. You know, they do things like drop your shampoo and your clothes and whatever. So they're like, well, why do you have all your clothes? And I was like, because you're going to throw me in prison. And lo and behold, the marshal just steps out and like is like, OK, you got it. And basically just cuffs me and I get taken to prison and which is, you know, I actually get taken to court where I have to sit in the bullpen for the whole day. And my lawyer had already, you know, I had talked to my lawyer that morning and said, listen, if I don't call you every hour, it's a problem. So when she didn't get my call at 9 o'clock, she called the halfway house, who then proceeded to lie to her and tell her that I was there, but I couldn't come to the phone or something like that. I get taken to court. My lawyers are already at the prison. You know, it's all within Brooklyn. So my lawyers are at the prison by like 5 o'clock that day. And they're like, you know, he's not even there. So I get eventually get my way back to the unit. It's like get put in. Of course, I get put in segregation. And I, of course, you know, I immediately I'm writing cop outs. I'm writing notices to like, you know, get a legal phone call. I want a legal phone call. I want a vegetarian tray. I want all, you know, I want rec. the next day they call me out at like 7 o'clock. My boss at the time, who's a radical lawyer, is there. She's visiting another client. So she pulls me out for a legal visit. And when I look at my door, it says no rec, cell alone, no communication. No, you know, they essentially, because I had come from the CMU, they were going to treat me on communication restriction, which is really just totally illegal, but they do whatever they want, especially when you're in the shoe, since you don't have any means to do anything about it. You know, I mean, you're completely dependent upon them for everything, right? So I go to legal and I visit with my boss and I'm sitting there in the orange jumpsuit and she's making fun of how pale I look with the orange. And I'm just like, this is not funny because I'm thinking I have to go back to prison for another 4 months until my sentence ends. And the way it works is they consider that you have a parent institution. Since I came from the CMU, I will be going back to the CMU to finish my sentence. And then lo and behold, my lawyers on my civil case show up. And they come in and they tell me, hey, listen, you're going home soon. And I was like, what do you mean I'm going home? And they're like, no, we talked to opposing counsel and this was a mistake. And I'm like, I'll believe it when I see it. And then like 20 minutes later, this lawyer from the BOP comes and he shoves a furlough paperwork through the door. He's like, can you sign this? And I was like, what does this mean? And he says, well, you're going to go home. It was a mistake. And they released me that day at 4 o'clock. I couldn't believe it. I was completely shocked. And I thought to myself, like, how lucky I was, because if I didn't have lawyers like that, if I didn't have the presence of mind to know that something was up, I would just be stuck at MDC for the remainder of my sentence. Or maybe they would have found me guilty of this infraction and they would have sent me back to Terre Haute. And then I would have had to make my way from Indiana, you know, back home. And it would have been a tremendous, you know, problem. I had a job. I had like, you know, I had rent. I had all these things going on. And we filed suit about that, actually. And lo and behold, 2 years later, we pretty much lost it. We had a really horrible judge, and they just basically dismissed it. And then we went to the appellate court, and it was dismissed. And it's crazy because they clearly broke their own rules, but somehow have gotten away with it. So our case just died. That's not the CMU case, but the case just with me suing about being in custody for 30 hours.
So you've been doing stuff around, like, not only have you been in prison and now writing about and paying attention to prisoner issues, but you've been doing prisoner support stuff for a really long time. And I was really surprised to hear about, like, your involvement with the North American Animal and Earth Liberation Prisoners Support List. I'm probably getting the acronym wrong, but...
No, you're pretty close.
Oh, okay. can you talk about what kind of projects you're engaged with now around prisons and... Yeah, what you're working on and such, how you got involved in the first place around prison issues?
Well, it's interesting. I got involved in prison issues pretty much right away. And it was because it was that time in like the late 90s in which animal rights activists were getting arrested like seemingly constantly. I always joke with my old friends that if we saw anything, we'd want to lock our necks to it. You know, it was like this era of like civil disobedience. Like people used to get arrested in New York at fur stores or at medical labs. I mean, there was campaigns against NYU for what they were doing with chimpanzees at the time. There were campaigns against, you know, these fake sanctuaries. There were campaigns against fur stores. I mean, it was really intense. So I was introduced. I sort of got radicalized at this time. The other thing is the first meeting I ever went to at Wetlands was in animal rights. It was called the Animal Rights Action Team meeting. And, you know, they were writing people in prison. Like the first meeting I went to, there was someone doing time, an animal rights activist, doing some time for some pretty inspiring stuff, and was a good writer. And so people were really inspired by that. And I started writing this individual and then got involved in their support campaign pretty easily, pretty fast too. The other thing, I think the first thing I noticed is when I walked into Wetlands, they were writing letters and they were being, you know, of course I was a new person, so they had to be completely unfriendly and like suspicious of me right away. And so, I was like, well, who are you writing? And they were like, oh, we're writing Paul Watson. And I was like, who's Paul Watson? I had no idea who any of these people were. And they're like, oh, he's the head of Sea Shepherd. And I'm thinking to myself, here we go. Like, okay, who's Sea Shepherd? And they were writing letters because Paul Watson at the time was being held in Norway or Iceland or somewhere in custody. And they were going to like extradite him or prosecute him for like interfering with whaling efforts. And the way that everyone introduced me to these topics was it was so second nature. Like, yeah, we're doing prisoner support, of course, because, you know, have you heard about Mumi Abu-Jamal? Or, you know, this was the late 90s was a period of time where there was significant, much more in my mind, activity around Mumia and Leonard Peltier and people like that, plus just a lot of like animal rights activists going in on short periods of time. So I got introduced to this right away. I'd always kind of been doing prisoner support. Initially, I worked with the Direct Action Defense Fund, which was the group for this prisoner at the time. And then when I went out west, I had friends that had been indicted on some stuff, some cases, animal rights case in Santa Cruz. And then obviously Jeff Fleur's free. He got indicted in 2000. And so the North American Earth Liberation Prisoner Support Network was started by myself and a few other people in Eugene that wanted to have a name for the sort of eco and animal rights prisoner support that we were doing. At that point, Jericho had existed for a year or two. The Anarchist Black Cross Federation started in 1996, but you know, they were very intensely focused on what they call class war prisoners, you know, class like you know, sort of the black nationalists and white anti-imperialists, at the time the Puerto Rican political prisoners. And so there wasn't much room for the animal rights and eco people. And so we thought they legitimately needed support no matter what you call them. So we started that group. We did a number of different newsletters and such, and as well as local support. What I'm doing now, I work on a number of different prisoner things. I'm not going to talk about all of them. But the main thing that I'm working on right now is the Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar. It is a wall calendar, which maybe in 2016 or 17 is becoming sort of antiquated, but we're keeping at it. We're going to continue to do it. The calendar is in its 16th year. It's a joint fundraising and educational project between a few different people in Canada and myself, as well as three political prisoners that are held at you know, upstate in New York State. It's David Gilbert, Robert Seth Hayes, and Herman Bell. So Herman suggested this project in 2000, and the process in the project has been sort of shaped by you know, all of us working together over the years. All the different members of the collective are involved in like day-to-day organizing work, other than the calendar, on issues like refugee and immigrant solidarity, to community media, to prisoner justice. The calendar, like I said, it's in its 16th year. It is a beautiful piece of work. I worked on it this year. I worked on content and getting art. And obviously, there's 12 major pieces of art in the calendar. We have a fairly significant involvement of art and writings from prisoners like David Gilbert, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Marius Mason, Kevin Rashid Johnson, Leonard Peltier, Oscar Lopez Rivera, Alvaro Hernandez. There's also just like some really great art by, you know, outside artists like Emery Douglas from the Black Panther Party, Sophia Dawson. There's great articles by Chris Dixon and Capital Area Against Mass Incarceration and the Termite Collective, which is an inside-outside collective in Montreal. And essentially, you know, the calendar, it's educational. I mean, it's essentially, you know, the dates are really good. There's like great moments in history on almost every date in the calendar, plus some room for you to use it as a practical wall calendar. But it also exists as a fundraiser. This year, it's a fundraiser for three different groups, one of which is a New York State group called RAP, which stands for Release Aging People in Prison. They're essentially the group that is mostly made up of formerly incarcerated people that are helping to sort of turn the tide on how New Yorkers are thinking about, like, it's like massive and aging prison population of 54,000 people. It also funds a group called Adamir, which is a prisoner support and human rights association in Palestine. And this year, our new beneficiary is a group called the Eunice Stoughton Camp, which is a homestead, an occupation created with the authority of the traditional chiefs of the Eunice Stoughton people in Canada, essentially occupying space and in Canada and stopping development. I'm really happy about how it came out this year. Obviously, you've seen it burst, but the art is really amazing. People can order it from certaindays.org. We essentially have ways where you can buy, you know, up to 9 copies from one distributor. But if you have an organization that you work with, you can buy bulk copies, which essentially means you buy like 10 for $8 each, and then you sell them for $12 and you keep the difference. And so you have groups that do that, like Support Marius Mason's group bought a bunch of calendars and they're selling them and using them as like gifts for like online fundraisers. And there's basically if you go to certaindays.org, you can find a list of stores to buy them in different cities. You can get them from AK Press, of course. And, you know, there's just a large like places to get them online as well as like info shops around the country.
If you do want to check out some of the art, too, it's up on It's up on certaindays.org. If you just click images and content, it shows you at least small versions of some of the pictures. They're really beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, we're sort of on the social media game. You can find us easily on Facebook by just searching it, and we're on Twitter at certaindays. But the website, yeah, we put up all the art, and we have bios of our editors. You know, we have like there's a lot of back and forth that goes on between our editors and us. You know, they've all been in prison for 35 years or more. You know, you have Robert Seth Hayes, who lately has been dealing with some really big health issues. So we dedicate some of our time to campaigning for his medical needs, try to get him an insulin pump and a monitor. And, you know, obviously all of the prisoners we're dealing with are, you know, mostly parole eligible and are being denied parole over and over. So we try to use the social media and the calendar as vehicles for, you know, securing the freedom of our friends.
So speaking of which, parole releases and such, also I got a call from Sean Swain yesterday, and he said that he just got knocked for another 5 years at a hearing. But there's some upcoming political prisoner releases in various states of freedom that were announced at the ABC conference. I was wondering if there are any that you'd like listeners to particularly keep an ear out for, or any words for post-release folks that are getting out?
Sure. Well, I think like what I said at the conference you're referencing is that, you know, our movement is getting maybe a little better at this prisoner support game. And you know, one of the things we're getting really good at is post-release support, and that, you know, support doesn't end when a person comes home, that there's a lot of different needs that they have, whether they're mental health, housing, job related, what they call collateral consequences, like the consequences of being a felon or having the terrorism stuff on your record. So yeah, in recent years, I think I've been really happy about how that's turned out. Yeah. So there are a number of releases coming up. My co-defendant Justin Solans is going to the halfway house in January. He doesn't have like an online fundraiser right now, but, he's going in January. His information is on the New York City Anarchist Black Cross website. I think it's, nycabc.wordpress.com. I know that Barrett Brown, who's a journalist and had done time for essentially pasting URLs related to Anonymous in a chat room, is getting out in, I think, this month. Actually, it's maybe November 29th, and he'll be going to a halfway house in Texas. The other thing that I saw, and it kind of ties in with some of the stuff I'm working on, is a Black Panther named Zolu Azania is coming home, and actually just last night they launched his fundraiser. He has been in prison since 1981. He actually was on death row for 27 years. He's a prolific writer and an artist. He actually has a book through Kersplebedeb, which is that book distributor in Canada. I think you can get it at leftwingbooks.net. And Zolo is getting out after, you know, obviously making very little money during the time that he was in. And he's getting out in February. He's an Indiana state prisoner, and he needs help. He has a GoFundMe set up at gofundme.com/helpzolorebuild. People can find that information online. There's a lot of groups that are promoting it, including New York City, ABC. Another thing that I'm working on, which isn't related to release, is Marius Mason's Education Fund. Marius is a trans prisoner and an eco-activist that is doing 22 years and being held at this rather insane secure housing unit in Texas at Carswell. And Marius has finally got approval to take some college classes and is, you know, needs obviously significant help. I think he's going to be taking classes through the Ohio University Correctional Education program that they have. And the coursework is like $350 per credit hour. So there was a goal to raise $3,000. And, you know, we were like 85% of the way there. But again, that's pretty easy. You can find that link on supportmariusmason.org. And, you know, obviously, every bit you give really helps Marius prepare for his eventual release, which unfortunately is in like 2027. Finally, I guess in terms of like support and release, I find myself often like being a former prisoner, a political prisoner, I find myself like keeping an eye out. There's sort of a growing number of people who have done time for political cases, and often we share a lot of similarities. It's not just our co-defendants or my co-defendants, but it's people that have been in at various times, and I tend to see these people at conferences and gatherings and such. And so, you know, recently I became aware of a situation. I'm not sure if you guys know about the Ohio 7 or the United Freedom Front. But these are people that did time. And in fact, two individuals, Tom Manning and Jan Lehman, are still doing time in the federal system. But there's, you know, there was originally seven or eight people, Kazi Tari, Pat Lavasser, Carol Manning, Tom Manning, Richard Williams. And so Barbara Kersey is one of these individuals, and she's been out of prison for some time. She did 8 years on a 15-year sentence for actions related to the United Freedom Front in the 80s. And she has been diagnosed with a pretty aggressive form of cancer. And so people are this week setting up a GoFundMe to help her basically pay her bills while she's getting treatment. And so we find ourselves like with a lot of our elders and our heroes and sheroes getting older, a lot of that comes, you know, there's a lot of health concerns, not just for the incarcerated people, but also our former political prisoners and former prisoners that have gotten out. And it's come up, you know, obviously there's a case of Rita Bo Brown and Ed Mead from the George Jackson Brigade. They also were recently struggling with some pretty serious health difficulties. So I think it's essential when we think about prisoner support to not just, you know, talk about our friends or our co-defendants or comrades, but that we, you know, we broaden our understanding of what prisoner support means to, like, you know, people that have gotten out and people that have gotten out maybe 20 years ago, because they're still part of our communities and they need support, obviously.
And it seems like that mentality sort of also extends to our model as anarchists and as radicals of what family looks like and what communities should do and what mutual aid looks like. Like, it'd be nice if, like, some of the lessons learned here in how to support our aging prisoners, our elders, or what have you, not only get out but also deal with the consequences of living and going hard for such a really long time for just causes, that we could take that into our own communities afterwards. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think those effects are pretty, like, long-term. I mean, I myself struggle. I've been out of prison. You know, I came to the halfway house in December 2012. So, you know, going on 3.5, 4 years, you know, and it's like, I used to think that, you know, I was surrounded by men when I was inside that, you know, I was surrounded by men that had like life sentences and 30-year sentences. And you know, my plaintiffs from the Aref case, I mean, they're just getting out in like a year or two. And I used to disparage my time and think like, oh, I was only in for 6 years. It should be, you know, easy peasy. But getting out and dealing with the world changing so dramatically, even during that 6 years, it's kind of hard to imagine. But things change so drastically. And you know, you become different. You know, you know these ways of getting by inside don't always serve you on the outside. And so that period of like adjustment is pretty intense. I'm still very much in it. You know, and I think, you know, prisoner support has to be perceived, you know, supporting friends, supporting people that have been through the system or been through really harsh stuff has to be perceived as beyond the, you know, the first couple months when they get home. And when it, you know, it's because everyone wants to buy you a drink at first, you know, and everyone wants to like pat you on the back. Hey, it's great to have you home. And, you know, there's a lot of that and that's all well and good. But really, it's the deeper bonds that get you through it, you know, years later when things are, you're struggling, you know, and it's kind of hard to not see, you know, the effects of incarceration on you, you know, like all the time. And I think it's important to have a broader analysis of that and to understand support as like sort of a long-term thing, not just like, oh, you're home, so we're all good now, you know?
So considering how heavy the things you've engaged with have been and how heavy what you continue to engage with is, what inspires you in your daily life, in your political life, as much as you separate the two?
Sure. I don't know if I separate the two too much, to be honest with you, which could be maybe problematic. I would say there's a few things that inspire me. One, I'm really inspired by these like deep bonds of friendship that I have with people and the support that I'm able to, that I've been able to get and sort of what I feel I've been able to give since I've been out. I'm inspired by people that are not necessarily the like, you know, of that milieu, like, you know, people that are really just struggling and trying to make the world a better place, whether, you know, and are not really too concerned with stupid dynamics of social movements that sometimes arise. You know, I'm inspired by my nieces. They bring me great joy. My sister has three children. I love them dearly, and they like bring a lot of joy to my life. They're very like, they could really not care less about, I mean, they don't know or care about any of this, my involvement with politics and, you know, prison. I mean, they vaguely know about it, but they don't, you know, it's, I'm just a dorky uncle to them. And I love that because it's a real better way of engaging, or it's just a different way of engaging the world, you know. In terms of political stuff, I'm really inspired by like what's going on in Standing Rock. That is just pretty impressive. I mean, I've been trying to keep up on what's going on with the resistance to the pipelines. I think it's really creative and it's great. I think the gathering of all the people in the Dakotas is amazing. It really makes me think about like the period, like how cyclical sometimes social change could be, and how like we have these periods of time where, you know, one thing ebbs and the other thing flows, and you have like this attention being paid to and generated by indigenous people in the United States that are, you know, talking about the confluence of culture and water. And I see the hashtag water is life. And the other day I was sitting there drinking a glass of water, and it just hit me, like, it was so cliche, but it hit me like how much I missed that when I was away, how like having access to, you know, clean, drinkable, cold water, and like how absurd it is that people inside, and people not just inside, but in different parts of this country, can't even get a glass of water. It just kind of shocks me. So I'm really inspired by that. I think the resistance out there is amazing. I think the potential repression is pretty great. And I hope that people are still there for the long haul when, you know, the cameras are away and that various B-list actors and actresses are not there, you know?
So outside of Standing Rock and the Unistoten camp, like, do you have any other, what other assessments do you have of current liberatory movements since your release?
Well, one thing I think is really interesting, I mean, obviously, like, I've been politically engaged for, you know, close to 20 years at this point. And one thing that's fascinating to me, and I always harp on people about, is, you know, we can't take for granted this, you know, we have, like, the pendulum swings. And I don't think you can look at society as like it's so obvious, as like there's this very clear-cut pendulum. But we have a moment right now, and that moment was created by, you know, generations of people pushing back, people on the inside and people on the outside. And we have this moment, right, where we can actually change the way that prisons are, or destroy them in totality. I mean, they're just the prison culture and the punishment paradigm are really, really and disastrous to our society, and it's like really ruined lives and ruined communities. And so, you know, it's not the 80s, and we're not watching 2020 do exposés on, you know, so-called Club Fed. And so we have the pendulum a little bit in our corner, and now is not the time to like mince words and to sort of accept the little reforms that are pushed this way, like these little tiny little decarceration programs, or, you know, transferring, you know, we close private prisons, but then we find out that the GEO group is heavily involved in post supervision now. Like, they're just going to find, you know, we deal with Hydra monsters, and it's just, we have to figure a way to cut these heads off while we still have sort of, you know, we have some element of society on our side. I mean, I don't think, like, we don't fight because we have people on our side. We fight because it's right and because we're fighting oppression. But knowing that we have, like, political space right now to push harder is necessary. And I don't think people should be enticed by, like, these really easy reforms. And so I think, like, things like the prison strike is really impressive. You know, I think in so much that it comes from inside, and it's not just top-down organizers from the outside pushing the strike idea on people, I think it's really authentic. I mean, and in some ways it's why, like, the prison strike, you know, that started on September 9th seems to continue on some level. It's strongest in the areas in which it really generated from, you know, like Michigan and Alabama and Texas, where people are, you know, fighting against what they're calling, and I think is righteously called, slavery. You know, the idea that they can be compelled to work for the government or for corporations in order for them to make a profit, you know, at on the backs of prisoners. So I'm inspired by that. And I'm also just like, feel like we need to seize the moment and push harder and not just have these like piecemeal reforms and not to be like too distracted by who's in the Oval Office. I mean, obviously some of the federal stuff that Obama did is interesting. It's never enough, and it's always so piecemeal. You know, you give clemency to 100 people, but then you consider there's 192,000 people in the federal system, and you think to yourself, like, is that really I mean, yeah, 111 people. If 111 people in your life had something happen to it, that'd be pretty amazing. But you're talking about a massive system. And you have 2.2 million people in prison. So, you know, it starts to feel like piecemeal, and we really need to not be too concerned with who's there and be pushing it, you know, while we still have people questioning what's going on in society with prisons and such.
Daniel, thank you so much for taking the time to have this chat, and really appreciate your thoughts. It was great to meet you, and I look forward to working with you in the future.
Oh, I really appreciate you for having me on. Thank you so much.
That was our interview with Daniel McGowan, and this is The Final Straw. And I'm William Goodenough. Thanks for listening.